From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and today we're questioning authority.
Quite a number of people are having their homes seized, or the Commonwealth is attempting to seize the homes of people who are actually not even being accused of a crime.
Driving while brown is taken to the next step. How local authorities are seizing your property and why it matters to Latinos. And
Guy Gabaldon, fighting on Saipan. But first he fought inside himself to prove himself a man.
The story of one Latino World War II vet, a real-life Superman in our midst, but you've probably never heard of him. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Quédense con nosotros. Stay with us. Welcome to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. On today's show, we're looking at questions of authority. Who has it? How do you get it? How do you hold on to it? And how do we define it? In this country, media in Spanish is a major authority, but it's rarely acknowledged, frankly, by the rest of the media. And it's also often ignored by our elected representatives. Take this recent example. When President Obama wanted to make his primetime case to the American public about intervention in Syria, he gave interviews to all major news networks except one, Univision. A diss is a diss. But to put this in context, Univision is now beating the other major TV networks, according to Nielsen. In July, Univision had more viewers in the coveted 18 to 49 demographic, more than Fox, NBC, or CBS. So, to talk about who gets to be seen as a media authority, we asked my esteemed colega, Jorge Ramos, to join us. Ramos is co-anchor of the evening news program Noticiero Univision and host of the weekend news show Al Punto con Jorge Ramos. He's joining us from the Univision studios in Miami, Florida. And he is, what can we say, una estrella de la media. Muchas gracias, Jorge.
Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me.
So let's talk about what happened with the president. What reason did the White House give for not scheduling an interview with Univision?
No reason. It's just as simple as that. They gave no reason and no explanation. Sometimes they simply don't see us. Sometimes they forget about us. They never, ever forget about us when there's a campaign or when there's an election. But after that, it's very difficult. Obviously, whenever they want to talk about Hispanic issues or Obamacare or obviously immigration, they talk to us. But when it comes to other issues like Syria, we don't exist for them. It's not only sad sometimes, but it's a little strange. Latinos are as concerned about the possibility of another war as any other American. But for some reason, they thought that Univision shouldn't be part of the six interviews. We were not included.
Jorge, if the numbers are clear, you have bigger ratings than CNN, than Fox News. Why is it then that Spanish language media has continued to be underrated or even ignored despite clear numbers?
Our world, I think, is wider than what you might see on English language television. However, it gets lost in translation. And I understand that. I mean, we can't ask the rest of America to speak Spanish. However, that's going to be changing very soon when we launch Fusion, a new network, a partnership between ABC News and Univision. We're going to launch it October the 28th. It's going to be in English. Some of the things that we are doing right now and that people do not pay attention simply because it's in Spanish, they won't have that excuse. And finally, we're going to have a network in English in which we're going to be able to present a Hispanic point of view, a young Hispanic point of view, a Latin American point of view, and that won't get lost in translation. And that would be fantastic.
So what are you going to be doing for Fusion? You're a little bit busy.
I'm going to be a little bit busy. I'm going to be doing a daily show, 1 hour 1 hour show doing interviews. Everything's going to be in English with an accent, but in English. And then I'll be doing the newscast every night. And on Sundays, I'll be doing the political show. I think I'm going to be very busy, but very happy. We've noticed a major change within the Hispanic community. And that is that the majority of our growth comes from newborns, Hispanic newborns here in the United States. And obviously, they feel much more comfortable in English than in Spanish. And that's why we need a network like Fusion to try to reach to those Latinos who would rather listen to you than listen to me.
Tan querido, Jorge. But what do you think that all of us in who consume mainstream media and that's not in Spanish, what is the result of not getting these stories being told consistently in English? Like, what is your pet peeve about the most missed story in the mainstream media in English that you know you're doing because you work for Univision?
Many networks are simply not paying enough attention to what's going on in Latin America. I think we are following Venezuela and Cuba and in Mexico as if they're local news. And that's a huge issue for us. You're only getting your news in English. You're missing tons of stories in the same hemisphere. And we are covering major floods in Mexico right now, the permanent crisis in Cuba. And those are stories that for us are almost like local stories, and that you would never hear anything about it in the English language media.
So, Jorge, you are an avid fan of Twitter, and on your Twitter bio, it says, inmigrante, periodista, conductor de Univision. So your first and primary source of identification as an immigrant.
I'm 55. I've been living in this country for 30 years. Both my kids, Paola, 26, and Nicolas, 15, they were born here. And I think, Maria, that they have a better life than the one I had in Mexico. So I'm so incredibly grateful for the privilege of living in the United States and being an American citizen. However, I still feel like an immigrant. Sometimes I don't know where home is. It's something that I see in other immigrants. Despite the fact that we're so incredibly grateful to this country, it is difficult to find home every night. At some point, I thought I had to decide between Mexico and the United States. But then having a conversation with a Chilean writer, Isabel Allende, after 9/11, she told me, you know, Jorge, we don't have to decide. We can be from both countries. To define myself before being a journalist or anything else, I think I have to say that I'm an immigrant.
Jorge, when you did make the decision then to become an American citizen, what do you say to the many, many Mexicanos who do have the possibility to choose citizenship? And as you know, Mexicanos are some of the ones who walk away from American citizenship even when they could get it.
I think it's an incredibly personal decision. It took me 25 years to decide that. And at the end, I decided to become a U.S. citizen because I wanted to participate in the 2008 election. It was a very important election for me. And I wanted to celebrate that I had become a U.S. citizen voting. You won't believe me, but it was the first time ever in my life in which I had the possibility to go to the polls. As a Mexican, I had decided not to vote in Mexican elections because of the corruption and because of the political dictatorship that we had in Mexico until the year 2000. So I had never voted in my life.
Jorge Ramos, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA. It's always a pleasure and an honor.
Gracias, Maria.
Jorge Ramos, inmigrante, periodista, conductor de Univision. Jorge Ramos, immigrant, journalist, Univision anchor. So do you watch Univision or Telemundo? Do you feel like the English language world is missing out? Send us a tweet or a Facebook mensaje at Latino USA. Talking to Jorge Ramos from Univision got us wondering how young people, especially young journalists, see the issue of authority in mainstream, ethnic, and community-based media. Latino USA producer Daisy Rosario spoke with an editor who has experience working both sides of the media language divide, along with some student journalists, for a segment we call News or Noise.
With more and more Latinos getting their news in English, are younger Latinos concerned about being addressed as a community? Or do they see themselves represented in the mainstream? I asked 19-year-old student Shanice Carr if Ramos's comments ring true for her.
I'm so happy that he actually stood up and, you know, said something on a public platform to the president and sort of puts pressure on the president to really address the Latino community. I think that it's important to recognize the Latino community in that specific regard because there are a lot of people in the military, a lot of Latinos in the military. And so, you know, this matter affects them personally, but they're not sort of catered to in that regard.
Maite Junco has worked for the Daily News and Bloomberg News. She now serves as editor of Voices of New York, a site that highlights the best in ethnic and community reporting. Junco says these outlets offer some things that the big networks don't.
I'm surprised, actually, that the president would not give an interview to Univision on something like Syria, to be honest with you, because I think the success of some of Univision and the TV stations in Spanish is that they're going to ask the questions in a different way, and they're going to get information that they think it's important for their viewers that perhaps they are not getting in mainstream media, either because of language or because of what they're hearing is not exactly that something that speaks to them. And I think there's a lot of people with authority who don't get their voice heard in our media world.
College student Angelie Mercado didn't see minorities represented as authorities. It affected the way she saw other areas of her own city.
Because some of the coverage that you get from lower income areas are very, I don't know, degrading. And they're very sad in a way. And then I go up there, I had a very bad perception of some areas of the Bronx before I started reporting for it. And I saw that a lot of the stereotypes weren't true. And that there's so much culture up there and a lot of arts and activism. And it's very inclusive. It's not as cut off as people would like to think it is. I'd like to see, I guess, more diversity in what's reported on, not just the tragic news.
Every time you see the Bronx, it's always crime and, you know, people, violent things, bad things. I mean, we do have to tell those stories of, you know, bad things that happen. My name is Fausto Giovanni Pinto. I'm a journalist studying at the CUNY Graduate School of Journalism. I think that's one of the main issues why I got into reporting. I did my undergrad at Hunter College, and the first major, you know, small newspaper was the Hunts Point Express, which was sort of a class where we write the stories. And I was like, I've never seen these stories in the newspaper or in the news. These are big issues. My family lives in this area. This is important to me. I've never, ever heard about, you know, this. I was like, maybe, you know, I can get involved with this and tell these other stories. One of my goals was saying, you know, there's a lot of good things here. You know, you want to focus on good businesses that are, you know, unique and authentic, and people want to come here.
Like Pinto, the lack of representation, the desire to add an authoritative voice has helped put Shanice Carr on her career path.
I fell in love with journalism because I found that my words can give someone power to make a change in their community, to really be aware of what resources they have and just take advantage of them. Because I think working with the communities that I did work with, there are a lot of people who are suffering from misinformation and a lack of information.
There's one major point Carr would like to see reflected in the mainstream.
A lot of people fail to realize that Latinos are also American, and American issues also affect them too, not just immigration, you know, also education, you know, war. You know, those different aspects also affect Latino communities just as much, if not more.
So besides Latino USA, of course, what sources do you go to for what news? And what gives them authority that makes you believe in them? Send us a tweet. We're at Latino USA. And coming up, how local law enforcement is seizing your property, your cash, or your home without even making an arrest. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I want to lay out a scenario for you. You're driving down the road in East Texas, doing 70 in a 55, and you get pulled over. As you talk with the cop, you get the feeling that you're in a driving while brown situation. After all, you were just speeding. You did nothing else wrong. But then the cop threatens to seize your car for what you thought would just be a ticket. And when you protest, however gently, you're told you could be thrown in jail. Sound impossible? Well, it's happening all over the country. Sarah Stillman is a staff writer for The New Yorker, and she told me about this phenomenon known as civil forfeiture. Her New Yorker article is appropriately titled Taken. Sarah, if you wouldn't mind telling me the first time that you heard this term, civil forfeiture, do you remember when it was, and what was your reaction when you heard about this?
I actually do remember because I'd been doing reporting related to the war on drugs, and I was in Detroit finding people even as young as 13 or 14 years old who were recruited as confidential informants. And I kept coming upon these cases in Detroit that had these weird names, you know, like the government versus, you know, $3,000 or something. One of the cases I was looking at, someone had come to a scene with money on them, but no drugs as the police had expected. The police seized the money and didn't place any charges, didn't arrest the person. That was that. And I said to a lawyer, you know, how is that possible? How did that work? And he said, oh, it's, you know, this thing, civil asset forfeiture, which is, you know, most people are familiar with this idea of criminal forfeiture, essentially that, you know, you're convicted of a crime. And if you had gotten the proceeds of that crime, whether you're, you know, a big drug kingpin and you've got your Malibu mansion, and then that could be taken away from you. Civil forfeiture was a whole new world to me.
I'm sure there are a lot of people who are listening to this who are saying, this sounds completely crazy, and I can't imagine that this is actually true.
One thing that really stood out to me was the situation in Philadelphia now, where quite a number of people are having their homes seized, or the Commonwealth is attempting to seize the homes of people who are actually not even being accused of a crime and have certainly not been convicted of one. And, you know, a family whose case I came upon is a couple, an elderly couple, Mr. and Mrs. Adams. The husband was struggling with cancer. They allowed their son to come and live with them. And the son was found to have allegedly sold $20 worth of pot three times to a confidential informant on the porch of the house. Police battered down the door. They raided the house. They take the son away. The son has still not actually been convicted of a crime even yet. But the homeowners, his parents, were sitting at breakfast one day. And again, police barged in and they said, you know, you've got 10 minutes to leave your home. And the Commonwealth is essentially attempting to seize your home. And what happens is there's a process in Philadelphia where homes are basically seized if they're believed to be to have ties to criminal activity. And they can be auctioned off, and the proceeds, which usually aren't very much, but still the proceeds go to the city and to the district attorney's office. And they also seize, you know, large sums of cash, millions of dollars worth of cash as well.
Yeah, so now what prosecutors say is, look, the mission is not to take houses. This is a quote in your article in The New Yorker. It comes from a place of public safety, providing a good quality of life for our law-abiding citizens in Philadelphia. So basically, we're not trying to harm anyone. We're just trying to do the best. And, you know, if somebody's dealing drugs, we're going to have to take that house.
Well, you know, it makes a lot of sense when it comes to crack houses, abandoned houses, the kind of houses that actually the couple I just mentioned about did spent a lot of their lives kind of fighting against, in the sense that the mother in that case was a member of the community betterment project. But when you look at kind of what are proportionate responses, and when you look at what are the consequences of seizing a home like that, and if they were successful, taking it and then trying to put it up on the market where these houses end up, you know, being essentially abandoned in a family that was actually living there since, I believe it was 1966, is now suddenly, you know, booted out on the street. Is that making communities safer? One question that Lou Rulli, who is at the University of Pennsylvania, he has a law clinic there that's been helping families in exactly this position. One of the main things he emphasized to me is the really racially disparate effects of these policies, how in the vast majority of instances he's seen, every single one of those cases, he said, involved a person of color. One very well-known example was the football coach in the area. A judge had ruled the home, quote, an emporium of drugs. And nonetheless, those aren't the kind of houses being seized. He argued that these are policies that are kind of enacted in a very selective way.
And given the fact that in your piece, you say, you wrote that in some Texas counties, nearly 40% of police budgets come from forfeiture. So is your concern, Sarah, that in fact, the whole notion of civil forfeiture it's not going to decrease. Rather, your concern is that it might increase across the board?
Well, you know, again, a lot of police really are facing huge tensions in that regard. And, you know, if you look at a place like Detroit, facing this bankruptcy issues, to be able to generate funds and to be able to put those funds right back into your force, it's clearly a very appealing notion and one that has led sometimes, you know, in Texas to more frivolous expenditures as well, or particularly problematic things like police receiving personal bonuses directly from the forfeiture funds. You know, in one case I looked at almost equal his salary in forfeiture proceeds.
So one idea that's entered into everyday life for people of color is people talk about being pulled over driving while brown or driving while black. And I think that some people might see that as another flavor of stop and frisk, the kinds of tactics that we have in New York. So do you see this civil forfeiture within that larger picture of a kind of stop and frisk by another name that, by the way, is targeting, again, people of color, Latinos across the country?
Yes, I mean, I heard some lawyers who used the term of stop, frisk, and seize. Sometimes these policies are actually a continuation of sort of the stop and frisk policies. And it's also, you know, relevant to mention that undocumented people are specifically quite vulnerable to this, because one of the big issues is that most people just don't fight back against civil forfeiture cases. You know, I spoke to a dishwasher out in California who was undocumented and his home had been raided and he was living there with his brother, and the raid was meant to target his brother, but they found, you know, his cash from the restaurant that he'd been working to save. At least this is his narrative of it. And he was very, very scared because he said, you know, I don't want to fight back to try to get my money because of my legal status. What was very interesting to me is that in most of the cases I saw where people did push back, they got their money back, often right away once they managed to kind of have legal representation and whatnot.
Sarah Stillman, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Sarah Stillman is a staff writer with The New Yorker magazine. She joined us at the studios of NPR's New York Bureau. For a link to Sarah Stillman's article, visit our website, latinousa.org. And if this has ever happened to you or to someone you know, send us a tweet and tell us about it. We're at LatinoUSA. And now, becoming the authority. Latinos are weighing in on the New York mayor's race in a way they never have before. In the days leading up to the Democratic primary, both Juno Diaz and John Leguizamo came out to endorse candidate Bill de Blasio.
I am the writer Juno Diaz. When Bloomberg sees a photo of de Blasio's family, he thinks racism. Me, I just think New York.
Paid for by $11.99 SEIU.
So why does this matter? Because on primary day in New York, voters in Brooklyn made history. They elected the first Mexican-American to ever hold office in New York City. Carlos Menchaca beat out the Puerto Rican incumbent for a city council seat in Brooklyn. Since there's no Republican contender, he's certain to be voted into office in November. Menchaca was raised in El Paso, Texas, by a single mother and arrived in New York 10 years ago. He'll also be the first openly gay council member to represent Brooklyn. And he joins me now in our Harlem studios. Carlos Menchaca, welcome to Latino USA.
Thank you. Thank you. It's so good to be here.
So you're from El Paso, Texas.
Tejano.
Tejano. When you arrived in New York 10 years ago, what did you first notice about this Mexican community?
Well, what I saw a decade ago when I got here was that there was so much pride that you immediately noticed it, and that I was very particular to the culture through the small businesses. And so there was a commercial, economic representation of the Mexican community. But I also noticed that there was no political. I noticed that from the beginning, that there was definitely no political, that it was a very heavy Dominican and Puerto Ricano political force.
So what's interesting in terms of your election is that while the Mexican community has really been growing since the late 1980s to now. It exploded in terms of demographics. The truth is that in terms of electoral politics, much smaller presence because so many Mexicanos are here undocumented. So in your district, Mexicanos did come out. They worked for, on your behalf. They organized whether or not they were citizens or not. They were still working on your behalf. And you did see a different kind of grassroots political movement. You're smiling because you're like, yeah, we built this. You built
it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I have to say, Las Madres Mexicanas, they came out so strong. And there was just a beautiful force. One of the mothers early on was like talking to us, and they're like, "Tú eres nuestro gallo." you are the one. And look, we didn't choose each other. We're going to do it together. And we're going to do it to the end. And they came out. And they came out with everything they knew how to do. Everything from making sure that I was well fed, that the community was listening to us in our language, in our culture. They registered their sons and daughters that just turned 18. And they brought them and they talked to them and they asked them to volunteer.
So here at Latino USA, we spend a lot of time talking about complex issues around identity. So it's true, you're not only the first Mexican-American in the New York City Council, but you are the first openly gay city council member representing the borough of Brooklyn. How do you manage these multiple identities? Has it ever been an issue for you, or is it completely fluid?
You know, for me, it's been incredibly fluid. And, you know, I came out in high school and I knew that the more that I'm comfortable, the more I'm going to have more impact in people's lives. And the moments that I decided to not open up myself and talk about my Mexican culture, talk about who I was growing up in my low-income home, whenever I didn't do that, I wouldn't connect with people in whatever thing anything that I was doing. And that is a very powerful thing to stand on, pride for who you are.
City Councilman-elect Carlos Menchaca, thank you so much for joining us
thank
on Latino USA.
Here.
That was Carlos Menchaca, the first Mexican-American elected to the New York City Council and the first LGBT council member to ever represent Brooklyn. So the authorities in Hollywood believe this conventional wisdom, that Spanish language movies don't do well here in El Norte. But comedian Eugenio Derbez said, "Eso no puede ser." Derbez is arguably the biggest television star in Mexico. So big that he set his sights north of the border. His new movie, Instructions Not Included, is the story of a Mexican playboy who gets a fling pregnant and then ends up having to raise the baby on his own in Los Angeles.
¿Qué hora?
¿Me escribí la carta?
Te mando un beso desde L.A. ¿Qué quiere decir L.A.?
Pues, la alberca, ¿no?
The movie made $10 million its opening weekend, the biggest opening ever of a Spanish-language movie in the U.S. One out of every four movie tickets in our country is bought by a Latino, so could this be a sign of things to come? We decided to ask Eugenio Derbez himself. Hola, Eugenio. ¿Cómo estás?
María, ¿cómo estás? Qué gusto.
¿Sabes qué, Eugenio? It is such a pleasure to have you on Latino USA. And the truth is that, you know, I did see you when I was, you know, when I would go to Mexico. I grew up in Chicago, born in Mexico City, and I would see you on Mexican television when I would go and you know, visit with my family.
Yeah.
But the first time that I actually saw you in person was when you were on Broadway.
Oh, yeah. It was 2005, more or less. Yeah.
More or less.
Yeah. And Latinolux, the play on Broadway. Yeah. That was my first play and my first work speaking in English ever. So I was really, really thrilled, nervous, everything.
So you decided that you wanted to make this foray into the American market, not on Broadway, but on the big screen. And so I want to ask you, are you still nervous and scared?
More than ever, because... Especially because I never thought this, it was going to be such a big deal. And, I did this film thinking in my crossover, actually. That's why this film, this Instruction Not Included, starts in Acapulco and then ends in LA. That's why it's bilingual, because I really wanted the film to do the crossover, but I never thought it was going to be this big.
You actually came up with this idea over a decade ago.
Yeah.
And you wanted to make a beautiful story that you wanted to tell for an American audience or for an American Latino audience or for a worldwide audience. What was the motivation?
For a worldwide audience, because I was inspired after I saw Life is Beautiful. And I thought I need to do something like this. I need to do a comedy, but with a lot of heart. And if you remember, Life is Beautiful was Italian spoken. So I was not really worried about the language. My instruction not included, it starts in Spanish and then it turns out to be a bilingual film.
So when you were trying to raise the money to do this film, and you would say to other producers, you'd say, well, you know, it's going to be about 65% in Spanish, but we're going to release it for an English language audience. Did people's jaws just drop and say, Eugenio, estás loco, you can't do that?
Absolutely, because, you know, we know that Americans, they hate to read. They don't like subtitles. And they thought I was crazy. But what happened was that the first weekend was so huge. So the Americans, the Anglos, were really curious about what was going on with the film. I think there is a huge market that nobody has taken care of. And now, finally, this movie, Instructions, is taking care of this market. And now I think things are going to change. I hope so, because they know there is an audience that can bring a lot of money into the Hollywood industry.
So what happens now? I mean, you said that you really wanted this to be your crossover. So now what, Eugenio? I mean, you're a huge star in Mexico. What comes next for you?
I don't know. It's really hard right now to tell you, because on the last 10 days, I've received a lot of offers. I need to take my time and put all the offers on the table and really, really think about what's the next step in my career. If I have to choose between acting and directing, I would go for directing.
Eugenio, I just wish you all the best, and I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak to us at Latino USA. Felicidades on your amazing adventure on making this film.
No, thank you for the interview, for the space, and let me thank everyone in the U.S., all the Latinos in the U.S. This victory is yours. It's not mine. I just did a film. I just did a movie with all my heart. But the ones who packed the theaters, the ones who made history, the ones who broke the records were all my beloved Latinos and Hispanics living in the U.S. So thank you very, very much. And thank you for helping me in this beautiful project.
That was Mexican comedy star Eugenio Derbez. Instructions Not Included is out in theaters now. So have you seen the movie? And what did you think? Tweet us and let us know. We're Latino USA. Coming up,
we are now not considered true Americans. The country has abandoned us and seeks our banishment.
The stories of unlikely deportees who happen to be U.S. veterans. Stay with us. No se vayan. Welcome back to Your Latino USA, tu programa. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And coming up, a postcard from one of our favorite actresses. But first, this is the oath all new citizens of the United States must swear.
I will support and defend the Constitution and laws of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That I will bear arms on behalf of the United States when required by the law.
Thousands of immigrants take that oath by signing up for military service in exchange for a promise of citizenship. But many veterans, immigrant soldiers with green cards, have seen that promise broken when they're threatened with deportation.
Dear President Obama, my brother and I are facing removal orders from the country we love and serve. We saw things and did things in combat that were horrible and difficult to describe. Some of my brothers are homeless, had incidents with the police, or have turned to drugs. We are now not considered true Americans. The country has abandoned us and seeks our banishment.
Valente Valenzuela and his brother Manuel are the subjects of an upcoming documentary directed by John Valadez. We'll get to their story in a minute, but first, we want to introduce you to a veteran who is in an immigrant detention center right now in Houston, Texas. His name is Norman McMaster. And a warning here. It's hard to get a phone while you're in an immigrant detention center. And when you do get a phone, service is often bad. So when we spoke to McMaster, it was hard to hear and hard to record.
You know, when I put on this
uniform thinking I would be a U.S. citizen.
McMaster is 54 years old. He was born in Antigua and immigrated to the U.S. at the age of 14. A high school dropout, he served 3 years in the Army and was honorably discharged. He believed that joining the military automatically made him a citizen, which isn't the case. After the military, he was briefly incarcerated 3 times on charges of burglary and assault. 6 years after his last prison sentence, though, he thought he was done. But then immigration officials showed up one day at his house. He's been in detention now for over a year.
This country has been good to me and my family, and everyone in my family is a U.S. citizen.
No one knows just how many veterans the U.S. has deported. Immigration officials say they don't keep track. But immigration lawyers and groups formed to help the deportees say possibly thousands of vets have been deported since 1996. That was the year things changed for immigrant vets. President Bill Clinton signed a law that took away judges' ability to decide deportations on a case-by-case basis.
The consequence of an aggravated felony is that there's no judicial discretion. That means that a judge cannot look at your case and make the kinds of decisions that ordinary humans would consider making.
That's immigration attorney Craig Shagan. He represents veterans who face deportation.
There are good citizens and there are bad citizens. The way we deal with infractions by citizens is we punish them. That's also what we do to aliens. But for somebody who has served in the United States Army, particularly in time of combat, to be then deported and stripped of his nationality seems to me utterly harsh and unreasonable.
When film director John Valadez found out that U.S. veterans were being deported, he was skeptical. But then he met the Valenzuela brothers.
I received the letter in February. The first thought that came to me was, why me?
He came around and he showed his removal notice then. That's Valente Valenzuela, my oldest brother. And he was in the Army in 1968 in Vietnam, got an awarded Bronze Star. I mean, my God.
He says, wait a minute, brother. So he walks to the bedroom, and he comes out with the same piece of paper.
And that's it. Join the club, brother.
The Valenzuela brothers are currently in Colorado appealing their deportations. They're facing exile from the United States for life. But there is one way to reverse deportation once it happens, you can come back into the U.S. after you die. Here's Director John Valadez.
Valente recently got a notice that there is a place in Arlington National Cemetery reserved for him because he was awarded the Bronze Star for combat heroism in Vietnam. So in death, he is welcomed in this country as a hero. But in life, he's banished.
And the strangeness of this story just continues. While deported veterans are still eligible for VA benefits, the countries they're deported to don't have VA hospitals. We've been watching the Latino Americans series on PBS. Last week, we talked about the first 2 hours of the six-hour series and about how this is a chance for younger Latinos to learn their American history. This week on the series, Latinos in World War II and the American GI Forum. In faraway Saipan, a teenager from East LA became a real-life Superman.
Acting as a Japanese interpreter for the 2nd Marines, Private First Class Cabaldon succeeded in capturing well over 1,000 enemy civilians and troops.
Using the Japanese he learned in East LA, in total, he killed 33 enemy soldiers, but captured 1,500 prisoners of war.
Gagabaldon, fighting on Saipan, but first he fought inside himself to prove himself.
He appeared on the classic reality TV show This Is Your Life in 1957.
And now, Gagabaldon, will you please accompany me as we gradually go back in time to the island of Saipan, where you inscribed a memorable chapter in the heroic annals of the United States Marine Corps.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm not, Guy. I'm not kidding.
In 1960, his exploits were turned into a Hollywood movie.
The amazing true story of Guy Gabaldon, the Marine who captured more than 1,000 enemy prisoners single-handed.
The lead in that film was played by an Anglo.
You tried and I'll put a bullet through your head.
That the real hero was Latino never made it onto the screen. And sadly, this was a metaphor for the stories of Latino veterans from World War II. Maggie Rivas is a journalist who has dedicated her career to collecting some of these stories. She joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. Welcome back to Latino USA, Maggie.
Thank you for having me, Maria.
Maggie, you started working on collecting the story of Latino World War II vets in what year?
1999.
You could have done anything with your journalistic expertise, and you decided to put it into telling the stories of Latino World War II vets. Why?
When I was a journalist and my last job was with the Dallas Morning News, I was putting together a magazine story about Mexican Americans and in Texas and civil rights and the advancements they had made. So in the course of doing that research, I couldn't find a lot of material. And I asked professors, why is it that I can't find an entire book about Latinos of the World War II generation? And they said there's so few of us doing the research, and I knew that oral history could serve as that primary source material. So it really came out of finding that gap in the literature that we could actually do something about.
What is the number of Latinos who served in World War II?
The best analysis that we have right now is that there were about 400,000 Latinos who served during World War II.
So you have spent years of your life collecting stories and interviews, and we're about to hear a clip from one of them. His name is Miguel Morado.
I remember a lot of times when I was in that foxhole and tired and hungry and scared, and I felt like crying. I thought about my mother. Then I remember In the Hispanic heritage, you say, los hombres nunca lloran. Men never cry. So I remembered, I said, no, los hombres nunca lloran. Men never cry, so I'm not going to cry. And then when I was injured, I said, well, I think I can cry now. No, the men never cry. And then one time when I was in a hospital, an officer came over and he says, Morado, yes, sir. You're moving. I said, oh, okay. Then after a while he said, Morado, I said, yes, you're going home. I started crying. I forgot my Hispanic heritage. Los hombres nunca lloran. I started crying. And I blamed that on my American heritage. Llorones, crybabies.
At the end of his interview, he sent us a letter and said, thank you so much for treating this topic so like it's so important. And you made me feel important. And I think about that all the time, and it makes me so sad to think that these men and women are in their 80s and they've made such tremendous contributions to our country, to their states, to their communities, and they haven't been made to feel that they were so important.
So what have you learned in the gathering of all of your information about the role of Latinas as part of the World War II generation?
The larger group of women were the wives, the sisters who stayed behind and tended the home fire while their men were away. And one of those fotovoces that you have, Maria, is of a woman whose name is Lita de los Santos.
My name is Lita de los Santos, and I had eight brothers served in the military service in 1942. So that took all the men out of the house. They were all gone. And I had a map on the wall that we would try to track them down, who was where, you know, with little pins that I would say, oh, this is Chalo and this is Neto and this is wherever they were. And then as the war advanced, I would move the little pins to where they were now.
And it's not a Latino or a Latina story. It's an American story.
It's a human story, really.
Yeah. Maggie, thank you so much for all of the work that you've done. We really appreciate it here on Latino USA.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you for your attention.
Maggie Rivas Rodriguez is a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. She heads up the Voces Oral History Project, and go to our website at latinousa.org so you can see how to link to them. We'll be live tweeting Latino Americans Tuesday night using hashtag LatinosPBS. Join us in the conversation. And we want to know, what do you think of the PBS series? Call our listener line and leave us a message with your name, where you're from, and how we can reach you. Your commentary could be on our next program. Our number is 646-571-1228. Rita Moreno is a legendary Latina, a proud Puertorriqueña, and a real authority when it comes to performing. She's the only Latina and one of very few people in the world to ever win the Emmy, the Grammy, the Oscar, and the Tony. We're excited to announce that Rita Moreno will be joining us for a live taping of Latino USA in California next month. She's also a big part of the Latino American series on PBS. And this year, she released her memoir. We stopped in for a book signing at La Casa Azul bookstore in New York's El Barrio neighborhood, where we met lots of excited fans.
Rita Moreno, who else? That's the woman. I mean, I remember being 7 years old, going to ballet and studying because of watching her on West Side Story.
She's opened so many doors for so many people. Television, theater, movies, you know, you name it. Finally a chance to meet her in person.
The fact that she said, you know, they want me here, I'm going to be here and see my people, I think it's fabulous.
Such a role model. And you don't have that much, especially in the Latino community. It's hard.
She's one of the first Latinas that I remember being on television. It was nice to see someone who was just like me. My parents used to say, you know, she's Puerto Rican.
It's very emotional. You know, you just don't see yourself represented in media. And every time you do, at such a level, it's just amazing.
I'm Rita Moreno, and I'm celebrating the publishing of my book, Rita Moreno, a memoir, in Spanish. Can I speak Spanglish? Yo soy Rita Moreno. Y acaba de salir mi libro en español que se llama Rita Moreno, Memoria. We're at the Casa Azul, which is the most charming little bookstore I think I've ever been in. The reaction has been really fabulous. The Hispanic community is delighted about that. Particularly the older people are so happy to have it in a language that it's easier for them to read than English. You know, what makes this so special too is that here I am in East Harlem. Mi gente. Oh, I'm sorry. With my people. It's like I'm family. It's just so amazing to me that there's this this kind of fealty that is just amazing. You know, it's like I belong to them, and that makes me very happy because it is how I feel. I think what's interesting with the Puerto Rican community is that they don't have that many representatives in the English-speaking world. But you know what's really fascinating? Do you know that three Puerto Ricans won Oscars? Raúl Juliá, José Ferrer, y yo. Is that interesting? From that tiny, tiny island have come three Oscar winners. That makes me very proud.
Rita Moreno, A Memoir, is now available in both English and Spanish, and listen for her on our live show in October. And now, mis queridos, how about some wisdom for this week? Our wise Latina, Marta Moreno Vega, has some sabiduría to share. Today, a dicho, a saying that she loves about those who help us through the hard times.
En las malas se conocen los amigos. Yeah, in bad times, that's when you know who your friends are. Who stands by you regardless of what the situation is, that's a friend. That's absolutely a friend. Family in a Latino context is generational still in our countries. Generally, when you're going through bad times, you have a network, a familial network that holds you up. Emotionally, economically, you feel loved, right? And you feel loved not by the only immediate mom and dad, if you will, but you feel loved by your grandparents, your aunties, your uncles, and so on, because there is that family. And there is even that extended family of tío político, tía política, people who have grown up with your family, who are part of that family. So that it's very important to sort of be able to identify who those friends and family members are that will be with you through thick and thin. En las malas se conocen a los amigos.
That's our show for this week. Latino USA is produced by Carolina Gonzalez, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Michael Simon Johnson, Diana Montaño, Daisy Rosario, Brenda Salinas, and Michael Jones. Our music consultant is Nadia Raymond. Additional engineering from Brendan Baker and Stephanie LeBeau. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin, and I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr at Latino USA, and you can find me on Instagram for a peek into my own adventures. We hope you like our show and that you'll come back again next week.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. This is NPR.